Hello, and welcome back to the sixth series of Beam Watch. I thought last weekend that the rain had stopped, and that spring sunshine had finally arrived. Well, it did in the south for 48 hours, and now the cold and the rain are back. Whoops, I think I just noticed some hail. The weather is of vital importance for my guest this week, Max Cotton, who is a former BBC reporter gone native. He spent a year attempting to be self-sufficient in food on his small holding in Somerset, only eating and drinking what he's been able to produce himself. This experiment has formed the basis of a BBC Radio 4 documentary series, which is being broadcast from next Monday, the 22nd of April, at 1:45 p.m. It's called Growing Solo. Max believes that broadcasters, and most of the country, do not understand the reality of farming and are out of touch with the countryside. Before I start, however, I should point out that Max's series is produced by Good Egg Productions, which produces this podcast. But I've had nothing to do with the series and can ask anything I like. I know you would not expect me to do otherwise. Max Cotton, thank you very much for joining us. I'm now looking at you at Zoom, I'd expected from your photograph of your days as a BBC journalist to see this very smart man with short back and sides, looking every inch the thrusting BBC journalist. How would you describe yourself now?
Just as scruffy as I always was. I have to say that I had a massive reputation for not being very well turned out at the BBC. So it's very sweet of you creating for me this idea that I was a smart Everest.
Oh, it was a glamorous image, I have to say. Handsome, no. And glamorous image, no beard. Now you're, how do I describe you now? Rather, more importantly, how would you describe yourself?
Weather-worn, care-worn, older than I'd like to be.
We have a lot in common.
I'm 60 in a few months' time, yeah. So I'm scruffy and I'm grizzled.
So is this project, in a sense, an answer to that middle-age or late-middle-age crisis that so many of us face? I don't think it is, because you've been involved in these sorts of issues for much, much longer. When did you really get interested in the countryside and the way it should, in your view, be, or the way it was? When did that really grab hold of you, was something at the centre of your life?
As a young child, my mum was absolutely determined that we weren't going to be suburban kids. My mum was from Derbyshire. She thought suburbia was this sort of soft southern state of existence, which she didn't approve of. And we grew up in a very, very rural village, and were left to go and have fun in the countryside. And we didn't have a TV, me and my brother. We didn't have a television. We wouldn't have any bicycles. We had to walk everywhere. And we just had this idyllic rural childhood. Very kind of, who was the nice man who wrote Cider with Rosie?
Laurie Lee.
Laurie Lee.
From Slad in Gloucestershire, yeah.
Very, very Laurie Lee type upbringing. And her father was very similar. He was her dad was a smallholder. They had a farm during the war and a cow and all sorts of other things. And so from a very, very young age, I loved the idea of producing my own food, growing up in the countryside, foraging in the hedgerows, poaching, brewing our own beer. I mean, Mum was absolutely delighted when we used to brew our own beer and make elderberry wine and stuff.
Was she equally delighted when you drank it?
Yeah,
and usually drank too much of it and were found in the, what, I don't know,
being
the
sick,
briar patch the next day. Yeah.
Exactly, being sick. No, she thought that was par for the course. There's a line in Swallows and Amazons where father, before they set off on their voyage, says, "If not duffers, we'll not drown." And I think my mum thought that if we weren't duffers, then we wouldn't drown, and we weren't duffers, and so we were going to be fine, whatever we did.
Well, you know, Swallows and Amazons, I was brought up just north of the Lake District. I loved Swallows and Amazons by Arthur Ransome. And Swallowdale, I didn't like it when he went down to sort of East Anglia and sailed out into the North Sea. But never mind. Or, I presume I liked it also because there was Titty and Roger and Susan and John and so on. Anyway, so, but when you went to into the BBC, therefore, and you put on your suit and you shaved and everything else, you're very smart. Did you feel you were going to a rather alien and somewhere artificial environment compared to the one in which you'd been brought up, because one of the things that comes out of the series is this sense of almost disconnection of most people from the land.
Absolutely.
Did you feel when you went into the BBC this was in a sort of disconnected world?
I was always a very part-time BBC-er. I was quite disruptive, and I used to go around the office talking to my friends most of the day. I used to work very, 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 very quickly in kind of explosive creativity, and then do very little a lot of the time. And so they were very happy when I sloped off to go and do other things rather than annoy people around the office.
Max, there's a story, by the way, that you did a rather lot around Christmas or just before Christmas when turkeys that
absolutely.
You were...
Absolutely, that is completely true. No one expected me to be around terribly much when we were plucking our Christmas turkeys, because we used to do about 400 or 500 Christmas turkeys. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm not a very well-known, you know, sort of BBC type figure. Look at the people I joined with: Nick Robinson and John Pienaar, Jeremy Vine, Hugh Edwards, all sorts of very, very famous people who were my generation in Westminster at the BBC, and no one's ever heard of me. And no one's ever heard of me because I was on the 1833 back to Glastonbury from Paddington as quick as I could. Rather than schmoozing around the corridors of Westminster, I was off home to move electric fences. And
did you get frustrated then when you, I mean, look, we all, those of us who were working in the BBC and politics and things like that, took ourselves desperately seriously, and we thought we were at the centre of the world and what really mattered. Did you always have a sense of which, hey guys, you're really out of touch with reality here?
I never ever thought of myself as terribly important or anything like that. I don't think I've ever been accused of taking myself seriously. Paul Heine, wonderful man, married to Libby Purvis, and a great writer and things, a great writer about the countryside in many ways. He tells a story about turning up at Broadcasting House for work and looking up at the sky and saying, I wonder if I'm the only person here who buried a sheep this morning. And I desperately wanted to get hold of Paul Heine when I read that and said, no, you weren't, because... I probably
there were two of us.
Two people turning up for work at the BBC who'd buried a dead sheep this morning. Yeah.
So why do you want, you know, I can understand why you want to make this series, because you feel so passionately about it and so on. But why should the listener listen? What is there anything really you would say important about this series, or is it just entertainment?
Well, it's very, very important to me. I did this project not with the view of making a film or making a radio program about it. I wanted to do this project because I've been champing at the bit for 40 years wanting to do it. I think it's fun to listen to. My children tease me relentlessly in this series. Plenty goes wrong. It's fun to listen to, and I've kept it. The radio program, I've kept it really nice and broad brush for general listeners. We could have gone right down a mine shaft talking about the food and farming debate and what's wrong with the world. And we particularly didn't do that because we wanted to keep it nice and open for the general listener. At the end of the day, we need to be paying much, much more attention to where our food comes from. And by definition, farming. People need to know much more about it. I'll tell you, I've got a story, Roger. When I was working in the Millbank newsroom during the foot and mouth crisis in the early noughties, and there was a picture on the 6 o'clock news of a load of straw burning on a funeral pyre where all these cattle were being incinerated. And the reporter said, and they've got all this hay that's piled up for the funeral pyre. And I was like, right, he doesn't know the difference between hay and straw. And I think that is really sad. And so I did this kind of straw poll in our newsroom. I don't know how many people work there in the Millbank newsroom, 70, 80 probably. And I did this poll, and I wandered around asking people if they knew what the difference was between hay and straw. And two of them did, out of 70 or 80 people. Two people knew the difference. And these are bright cookies. You know, these are finding someone who hasn't been to Oxford or Cambridge in that kind of environment is really difficult. These people really know a lot about the world, and they don't know anything or anything like enough about the rural world, where our food comes from, which actually keeps us alive. And I think that is That is not okay. As a group of people, BBC journalists, you know, they could tell you everything. As a group, they could tell you everything you could possibly want to know about Labour education policy. And they don't know what the difference between hay and straw is. And I think that's a sad reflection of where we are.
Now, when you set out on this process of recording a year in your life of living off the, I suppose, off the land, but anyway, no, growing anyway, only those things that you're going to eat, you didn't seem to persuade any of your members of your family to join you. In fact, one of the enjoyable things about the process is that your disbelieving sons in particular, quite a number of those, who don't believe you're going to make it and have no desire to follow you. I mean, they were actually shocked at the idea that you, a lifelong coffee addict, should actually put coffee aside. Did you attempt to recruit them? Or what was it like sitting at a table where they're eating a range of exotic foods, if you like, from around the world, and you are, well, I want to say eating potatoes every day, but quite a lot.
I did eat plenty of potatoes, I did. Why didn't they join me? It's always... You always rebel against, or people generally often rebel against their parents. So it's always the bishop's daughter who winds up in a creative musical environment in a squat somewhere. And it's always the Conservative MP has the crazy lefty, you know, son who's going on all the demos and stuff. And my children were brought up in a beautiful, idyllic small farm in Somerset, and they really resent that they didn't have a second floor flat in Clapham. I mean, they're not happy about this about this rural idyll that they've been brought up with, and so
although they'll return to it, I bet you they return to it in their 40s and 50s, but never mind, could it continue?
So they really resent that. They wanted to be 50 yards from a latte growing up, and the fact that they weren't is a cause of resentment. No, look,
it's not just a cause of resentment, it's a cause of great enjoyment listening to the banter, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, children tell the truth about their parents, don't they?
Some of them really muscle in and have done enormous out of work over the years helping me, to be perfectly fair. They're all really interested in food and drink. Absolutely all of them. We're all real foodies. But it's a hell of a commitment. I mean, even going anywhere, I remember taking... my son Jack, he's at Sheffield University, and I remember him taking him back to university in the car. And I had, you know, a great big flask of nettle tea. I had my breakfast in my little, because I couldn't, you know, if I'm going to be away for the whole day going to Sheffield, I've got to take everything I'm going to eat and drink with me. And so
you can't stop at a roadside cafe, because there's nothing you could eat.
No, there's nothing I can have. It is a fiddle. I think it'd be too much for a group of young people to be trying.
Now, when you look at the conditions in which, you know, what you actually did, you didn't cheat. You were honest about the fact, for example, that you had to buy salt. Because you couldn't get that. But, of course, then you're also using machinery at various times, which uses oil and things like that. So what were the precise... So you couldn't exclude yourself from the outside world. And another point, when you need people to help with the harvest, you feed them bottles of wine, because you have, obviously, quite a few of those around, growing your own grapes and so on. But what were the parameters strict parameters you put around what you could eat and what you could use in the production of that food?
Okay, so... this was about food self-sufficiency. This wasn't about any other type of self-sufficiency. So it was only to do with food. I wasn't taking my daughter to school in a pony and cart in the morning. So it was just about food.
You weren't trying to get out of the 21st century, were you?
I probably was.
Well, in a medieval sense, you wanted the food to be, but I mean, it wasn't a whole-scale rejection of life. You live near Glastonbury. If you go near there, or you go to Totnes, you will find people who actually seem to be doing their best to get out of the 21st century. You weren't about that.
No. So it was just about food. But in terms of the rules around food, they were incredibly strict. So I was only allowed to import salt and obviously water, because I was using water out of the mains, but absolutely nothing else. So I was allowed to pick blackberries from the hedges on my own small holding, but not blackberries from hedges in the rest of the village. Absolutely everything I ate had to come from within the boundaries of my small holding. What I didn't do was exclude things that are part of the food process and the cooking process, but aren't actually food. So a lactic acid bacteria which you use to inoculate milk when you're making cheese. I bought that in. Yeast I bought in for my bread making. I could have made a load of sourdough, I suppose, but yeast I bought in. So these are things that aren't actually food, but are an important part of the process. And the main reason why I had to do that was that my wine, we've got a small vineyard here, we produce about 1,000 bottles of wine a year, and my wine is not actually made here. It's made by someone in the next door village. And he is using all sorts of things like sulfites and sulfates and various other things in the winemaking process. So either I was going to have to not drink my own wine, or I was going to have to sort of fudge that somehow. So
let's just be clear, you did drink your own wine.
I did drink my own wine.
Couldn't go to the pub, presumably you couldn't go to the pub, or rather you could go to the pub, but you couldn't drink anything in the pub that wasn't produced by yourself. So you're a wino, basically, now, yeah?
Yeah. I could have. I didn't actually go to the pub, or did I? No, I don't think I went to the pub. I could have gone to the pub and taken a bottle of my own wine there, which would have been absolutely fine. And on my birthday during the project, I did actually do something similar to that. So there was a wonderful chef who was actually recently on MasterChef Professionals. Mm. There's a wonderful chef in Glastonbury, Aisha. And I rang her up and I said, if I bring all the ingredients, will you cook me and Johnny, my eldest son who was here, will you cook us dinner? And she said, of course. So I got a load of stuff together and took it into her. And she made me this beautiful, beautiful dinner from my own ingredients, which was just wonderful. Really nice.
So at the end, I don't want to go into great detail of the ups and downs and the quite a few downs, because that would give things away. But at the end of it all, you've survived, you're in decent health and so on. But what do you think you've proved?
Well, I've proved that it was a terribly important thing for me to do, because I got some agency. I have a big issue with how powerless we are as a population living in this very, very modern society. Everything is provided for us by someone else. We are not expected to provide anything for ourselves. And I think that is incredibly impoverishing. And so, as a one-man protest against the powerlessness that we have in modern life, I think it was a great success. I was really glad I did it. It's exactly what I wanted to do. I knew that I wasn't going to fail because I was so completely committed to it, to the project. I knew I wasn't going to fail.
But when it was over, do you head straight for the chocolate?
Bakewell tart. Bakewell tart was that I had this. I was talking about taking Jack to Sheffield. On the way to Sheffield University, you could go through Bakewell, and I suddenly had this kind of. I was obsessed. We'd go about Bakewell tart. I was like, God, just imagine Bakewell tart, how delicious, and almondy, and just so sweet and everything. So the first thing I said, right, I'm going to have a Bakewell tart. And I was going to go and buy a sort of Mr. Kipling's Bakewell tart. In the end, a friend of mine made this beautiful, beautiful Bakewell tart for me to have. So that's how I broke my diet with Bakewell tart.
In the programmes, your son says, half-jokingly, but only half-jokingly, I dread to think what he's thinking of next. So what's the answer to that apprehensive question?
It's already underway. One of the things that was so frustrating for me was I wanted to do so much in the way of making pâtés and exotic pork products, and I wanted to make lots of different types of beer, and I wanted to do all sorts of things with wild food, and I just didn't have the time. If you're working, I work 18 hours, I drive a school bus 18 hours a week, and I was recording all this stuff for these programs, plus I was doing all the other things I have to do around the house, plus I work as a relief milker for a neighboring dairy farmer. And so once you're working and taking people to school and picking them up and cutting wood and all the other things that I do, there just isn't enough time for you when you're producing your own food. Everything you eat has got to be dug up out of the ground. It's got to be washed. It's got to be prepared. It's got to be cooked. And that there just wasn't anything like enough time. And so what I decided that I wanted to do was to have more of a community and group together. So we've now got 5 or 6 other families of small farmers immediately around me who are all clubbing together, and we're slightly specializing. So one of a biodynamic farmer has got a really nice farm up on the hill above the Glastonbury Festival site. Wonderful guy. He is going to grow our cereals and field-scale potatoes and things like that. Got 2 market gardens, organic market garden people around me. They're going to grow all the vegetables. I'm going to do all the dairy and the cheese making and all the rest of it. And we're going to see if we can't make 10 or 15 of us completely food self-sufficient for a year and see what happens. We've called ourselves the Magna Barter, which I think is rather good. The Magna Barter.
And so
the idea is that we share all our food. No money changes hands. And we share our food as a sort of small community. Because with 10 of us together, we couldn't just feed ourselves. We could feed the whole village of 1,000 people if we wanted to.
Well, I very much look forward to that. But if I was conducting a current affairs interview with you, I would say, now, hold on. It's fine for you. But how about all, you know? But we have to be net importers of food. And hold on, there are a whole range of countries, third world developing countries, who depend on being able to export to us. And there are a whole raft of other people, obviously in cities and elsewhere, for whom your lifestyle is not possible. And therefore, even if everybody in the countryside followed it, the amount of food that would be produced would be insufficient to feed us. So if I was doing a current affairs interview, I'd push you in that way. And what would you say to all of that?
I'd say upscale it. I mean, we're already working on a model now where we could feed 1,000 people living in this village. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't feed the whole of Yeovil in a similar way, or the whole of Bristol in a similar way.
But I like bananas. You can't, for example, I like bananas, and there are lots of African countries who and Caribbean countries who depend upon Caribbean countries in particular us eating bananas, because that's what they have to sell. What are you saying to them, that they shouldn't do it?
No, I absolutely don't get what you're saying. Of course, bananas don't grow here, and if people want to eat bananas, then they can come in. That's absolutely fine. What is completely bananas is that we import half our food when we don't need to. And for the last 60 or 70 years, the government has pursued a policy of food security rather than food self-sufficiency. It's more to do with being a member of NATO, having nuclear weapons, getting on very well with our neighbours as best we can. And it's not to do with producing our own food. And what we're doing is we are exporting environmental damage. When we buy, because you say, I like bananas. You also want to be able to buy a pepper or a tomato every single week of the year. You also want to be able to buy French beans every single week of the year. Those things are not in season in Northern Europe. And I don't see why we should be eating them. The sort of food you're talking about, how much we import and everything, is not bananas, Roger. It's a huge chunk of our fruits and vegetables that we could easily not be eating.
Accepted broadly that argument. I'm slightly surprised that you're so reject the idea of food security, because I would have thought that in a whole range of areas, including energy and defence and elsewhere, the lesson of the world is that you can't simply rely on other parts of the world to deliver what you want. You have to take an element of your policy. It has to be food security, it has to be energy security, and some would say, I would say, defence security as well. So there has to be, to a degree, yes, a greater focus on ensuring that we can produce, in terms of food, some basics. But it's surely by collaborating with others that we're able to have that wider and richer diet.
I really don't understand why you're making that argument, given what's going on at the moment. Look at what's happened. The Ukraine is the breadbasket of the world. It's a war zone. And never before has the world's food security been more threatened than it is in Ukraine.
Well, what are you telling these Ukrainians? Are you telling the Ukrainians they shouldn't produce wheat?
No, of course I'm not. But energy. Go and ask the Germans how things have been for them without Russian gas. Energy security is absolutely incredibly important. It can't possibly be detached, particularly given our environmental responsibilities, from the ideas of self-sufficiency. Britain was, for most of our lives, was entirely energy self-sufficient until about 1979 because of coal. Now we have to import loads and loads of our energy, and we're trying to reverse that with renewables and all the rest of it. So we are more secure because we produce our own. The idea of food security, given the fact that the Ukraine is a war zone, we should be producing more of our own, and we can. We can produce an enormous amount of our own food, and it would be very, very much better for us and a lot worse for Mr. Putin.
Well, I think that's just demonstrated how passionate you are about this project. But I want to say one final thing. Is there a little bit of you that would quite like to go into the, with an election coming up, you know, if like pop back into the newsroom and do one of your old jobs in working with about politics, or don't you care ultimately now anymore?
No? God, no. I'm way too old. They're all so young. I'm way too old. And also, I like watching too much. No, God, no. I'd much rather be a bystander and a shouter at the TV, a fulminator. Is that the right word?
Well, I'm glad you would also hear you fulminating in this radio series. Max Cotton, thank you very much for joining us. My thanks to Max Cotton. Growing Solo is on BBC Radio 4 from next Monday to Friday at 1:45 p.m. And thank you very much for those of you who've donated to our crowdfunding page. You're still able to do this, but also please consider regularly supporting us. You can do this by signing up to patreon.com/bwatch for £1.99 per month. And you'll also receive a weekly blog which gives my take on the week's interview. The link to this and our crowdfunding page you will be able to find in the description of this programme. And that's it for this week. And as you know, this broadcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Until next time, goodbye.